Coming up on Boston Public Radio, the president will speak to the nation tomorrow night about ISIS. CNN's John King will tell us what to expect and why the delay on that immigration executive order. Then we'll shift to politics at home on primary day with Peter Kadzis. Will any of the key races keep us up late tonight? And will New Hampshire Republicans send Scott Brown on to challenge Gene Shaheen? Then to Nigeria with the producer of a new Frontline film which shows graphically that the only force as brutal as Boko Haram, the kidnappers of those 300 girls, is the government itself.
Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School on procrastination. Some new science says it's not so bad. We'll ask her and then ask you. If your mail's piled 2 feet high in your living room, is it time to take stock of the situation or not? Then WGBH arts editor Jared Bowen on the best new theater and film around and a gem of a museum you may not even know about. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Hey, Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Election Day.
Well, you look at a little sticker on the back of my cell phone.
Oh, wow.
I voted. Would you know what that means in Massachusetts? I'm a 15%er, sadly.
No, it's pathetic.
According to the Secretary of State.
Yeah, I'm going to get there. I'm weighing my options, Jim.
Okay. How low can you go is the question. That's a question President Obama's come to terms with. As his approval ratings continue to drop, even in blue states, by the way, is putting off immigration really the best way to salvage the midterm elections? And is there anything the president can say tomorrow night at 9 o'clock that will reassure the nation and for that matter, the world, about how to take on ISIS? Joining us on the line to get us up to speed on these and other big stories is CNN's chief national correspondent and the host of Inside Politics. That, of course, would be John King. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon. Happy primary day.
And to you.
To you, too. You know, John, Jim just mentioned that he's one of the 15%ers that's expected to vote in Massachusetts. Maybe we'll get up to as high as 20%. Is this are we typical or atypical? Do you have any idea?
So you do have a very low turnout this year in the primaries, and in part that's because it's a midterm election year and turnout is down anyway. Primary turnout is always lower than general election turnout. But I do think you have an added element this year in that you have bipartisan just disgust with politics. Now, you've got a governor's race there, so sometimes the state race makes the difference. There's no question people are disgusted with Congress, but you've got a good up on the North Shore. Everyone assumes John Tierney will survive the Democratic primary today, but let's see what happens. Let's see what the vote is. Let's see if the unions who back him, can they get their people to turn out and vote? Or do people just say, no, I don't care. Or they're all the same. So you learn some things from primary turnout, especially the constituencies, and you might learn a little bit about anti-incumbent sentiment, even if the incumbents don't lose. How big is the opposition vote? That's fun to watch, interesting to watch.
Well, let's move on to Barack Obama. He's, of course, going to be addressing the nation about the situation tomorrow with ISIS. And he's going to be taking an offensive here. What do you expect him to be saying?
Well, I think that's the great question, Marjorie, in the sense of how specific will the president be. He's going to say they put together this big coalition. He's going to say they now have this unprecedented Arab help. They have unprecedented European help, and they put this coalition together to take military strikes and diplomatic action and other things to combat ISIS. But forgive me to borrow a line from Ross Perot, the devil here is in the details. Are the Saudis just going to say we're part of this, or are they actually going to step up and do something? Are other Arab nations going to just say they're part of this and they want to be part of the solution, or are they going to take risks and do it? Are they going to stop supporting extremism in other cases? That's a huge challenge for the president and Secretary Kerry to keep the coalition together. And I think the primary question for most Americans will be, what additional military steps are you prepared to take? Are you ready to launch airstrikes into Syria? When you say no boots on the ground, does that mean absolutely no boots? Or is there a possibility you drop special ops troops into Syria to act as spotters or to gather intelligence before you launch these airstrikes? And the president's going to deliver this speech. On the upside for him, the American people support a more muscular response. They believe the ISIS threat is real. The downside for the president, and this is a mess of his own making because of what he publicly said when he said we don't have a strategy yet, in our new poll, two-thirds of the American people don't think he has a plan. Hard for the president to lead a country that has deep memories of Iraq and Afghanistan into a potential military conflict that could be part of an anti-ISIS effort that even the president is going to tell us could take years. by the time they don't trust him. So he's got a credibility bar he has to get over first.
You know, I wasn't surprised by that number. I heard you say this morning on CNN you're surprised the number wasn't higher in light of the fact the president acknowledged the other day that he didn't have a plan. The thing that shocked me in the new CNN poll, 70% of Americans think ISIS can attack the United States. Is that just spillover from those horrible videos, the executions of Sotloff and Foley? Where does that come from, John King?
I think most of it comes from the barbarism, but I also think because of the barbarism has no doubt made it much more real, made it much more personal, and made it much more local. This might be an unfortunate statement, but the American people did not seem as concerned about the ISIS threat when they were taking territory in Iraq or territory in Syria and killing Syrians and Iraqis or killing fellow Muslims. It didn't capture the American people's attention as much. They viewed it as someone else's problem. I'm not saying they didn't think it was horrible, but they viewed it as someone else's problem. Now they view it as our problem, and they view it as a threat against us. And with that coverage has come, you know, listen to the guy taunting Barack Obama, President Obama, in those videos as he beheads. I don't know if it's the same person, but, you know, it's a British accent. And then you have all the coverage about Americans. You've had the coverage right there in Boston about this, perhaps the guy helping them with their social media lives right there in Boston, Massachusetts, or went to Northeastern and to UMass. So I think Americans have realized that there are Westerners, including Americans, being radicalized by this group and others, and they have passports that allow them to go back and forth. And so I do think there's been a, you know, I think we've gone over a threshold in the sense that if you go back to about 2005, 2006, when opposition to the Iraq War rose up, when the Democrats had the big sweep in the 2006 election, Barack Obama became a national politician by saying, I'll get us out of Iraq, I'll get us out of Afghanistan as soon as possible. The support for use of military force overseas, especially in the Middle East, has dropped a lot, and now it's on the way back up again. And I do think we're at a defining moment again where our politics are changing. The question is, you know, now how does the president step into this moment?
Well, you know, John King from CNN, when you talk about the president's credibility, I want to ask you about some dancing he did about this whole the remark he made back to the New Yorker in January when he called ISIS the JV team. He said the analogy we use around here sometimes, this is Obama, and I think it's accurate, is if a JV team puts on Lakers uniforms, that doesn't make them Kobe Bryant. Now, obviously, he regrets that and now because when he was on Meet the Press on Sunday, he tried to say that he wasn't necessarily talking about ISIS when he made that remark. But, of course, good reporters went back and looked at the transcript of the interview with the New Yorker, and indeed he was talking about ISIS. So, you know, it doesn't help your credibility to get on Meet the Press and say something that's kind of strains credulity.
No, it doesn't. Look, the transcript makes clear the question was about ISIS. Is it possible that the president, because he was still thinking in his head about a previous question, or as he answered the question, his mind wandered to the, you know, Boko Haram threat and the al-Shabaab threat? And he was giving a more broad answer, even though he was asked a more specific question. You know, we don't read minds in our business, and we have to be careful. And as all of us are, you know, you guys do this live radio show all the time. I do live television all the time. You know, sometimes you do get distracted, or you think you were asked one thing and you start saying something else. So I want to give the president a little bit of grace. However, the transcript is quite clear that he was asked about ISIS. And his answer to say JV, it is no mistake for people who say you were asked about this and you said that about them. And so if the president's mind wandered, you know, only he knows that. There's no question the transcript says he was asked about ISIS and he used the JV team. And that's undermined the president because it's allowed his critics, justifiably, to say he called them the junior varsity. Maybe we're in this threat now. Maybe this threat is at a bigger level now, a more serious level now, because the president didn't take it seriously months ago or a year or two ago, didn't respond more quickly, and didn't start to educate the American people maybe about the fact that, you know, we might have to do this. And so, you know, what, fair or not, and again, the transcript doesn't lie, it is part of the argument the president's critics have for saying, you know, that this is a harder problem to deal with now because the president underestimated it before.
Hey, John, one last thing about ISIS. We talked about where the public is. How about Congress and the president? I know he's consulting with leaders of the Congress today. Is he going to seek congressional approval for what he does, or is this, in my opinion, the best of both worlds for Congress? You demand that he seek your authorization, but then he doesn't do it, so you don't have to take responsibility for how you voted. What's going to happen here?
Yeah, part of this is the age-old tug-of-war between presidents and the legislative branch over who has the authority, how far can the commander-in-chief go. So there's a constitutional debate that we've seen in many administrations, and the president says he doesn't need Congress to do that, that he wants a quote-unquote buy-in. He doesn't want a resolution of authorization like we had for the Iraq War, but but he wants a congressional buy-in. That could be a non-binding resolution. That could be just the, you know, just an appropriations to give him the money. If Congress votes to approve the money, you could say implicitly they're approving what the president's doing. There are some members of Congress who are dead serious, who believe, you know, their reading of the Constitution or their reading of the political mood is that the president should seek that authorization. And that range is a broad spectrum. Conservative Oklahoma Senator Jim Inhofe is introducing legislation that essentially gives the president a blank check. You've had Rand Paul, who says in, you know, his reading of the Constitution, the president doesn't have that power. You've had Tim Kaine, who was, remember, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee under Barack Obama. He's a friend of the president, saying he thinks the president should come to Congress. But you're right, Jim, in the sense that most members of Congress, you know, are saying, you know, we'd like the president to consult us, or perhaps the president should ask for a vote. A lot of them actually would prefer not to take that vote because we're 56 days from midterm election, and some of them have, you know, memories of the Iraq debate. And when, you know, Hillary Clinton took that vote, it sure seemed like a safe vote at the time, didn't it? And it blew up in her face. And so some of this is hypocrisy or politics as usual, if you will. And it's a subplot of the debate. As we speak, the president does not plan to ask Congress to give him that power. The question is, will some voices in Congress try to force big votes anyway?
We're talking with John King from CNN. John, speaking of midterms, we've been talking to you weekly about immigration. Now, it seems like forever and a day, but the political speculation now is that the president is slowing down on his efforts to reform immigration because of those very midterms. Is that really the true story, or is there something we're missing here?
No, it's the true story, and the president is more or less conceded it, even as he pushed back in his Meet the Press interview this weekend, saying, oh, it didn't have anything to do with the midterm elections. Then in the next breath, he said, look, the politics on this issue have changed over the spring and summer because of the crisis at the border with the undocumented children. You know, the president knew back in June when he came into the Rose Garden and said, I'm going to act, and I'm going to act soon because the House Republicans won't take a vote. He had to know the politics, but they've gotten worse, and he's had an appeals from any number of these vulnerable Democrats and the consultant class in Washington, that if you do this, if you use your executive power to give de facto amnesty to pick a number, some White House aide said he might go, you know, as high as several million undocumented. If you do that, the advice to the White House was, you can guarantee a Republican Senate because we will lose North Carolina, we will lose Arkansas, we'll probably lose Louisiana, we may lose Iowa and New Hampshire. So go ahead, Mr. President, if you're going to do that, be prepared for a Republican Senate. So now the president is saying he's going to do it after the election. It's cynical. It's political. It's not all the president's fault, if you will, for Obama supporters out there. He's right that the Senate passed a bill and the House Republicans refused to touch it. But the people who are most mad about this are Latino activists who remember Barack Obama in 2008 saying, in my first year in office, I will introduce legislation. He never introduced that legislation. Now, he says it wasn't going to get anywhere, but he could have introduced it and lost, but he didn't. And every year since, they've been promised something, and every year since, when it comes to decision time, and there's some other political calculation, and this time it's the midterms, they get told you're going to have to wait. They are furious, and they are mad at this president. His only blessing in that is that the Republican standing with that community is even lower, and the distrust of Republicans in that community is even lower than it is with the president. There would be a giant opportunity here. We've talked about this before. Look at the demographics. Study national politics. You can't be a serious presidential party if you can't compete in Florida, if you can't compete in Nevada, if you can't compete in New Mexico, if you can't compete in Illinois, increasingly in states like North Carolina and Virginia. The Latino population is the fastest growing swing population. There's such an opportunity here for Republicans to step forward and say, if the president won't help you, we will, except they have their own problems on this issue. And as much as Speaker Boehner might want to act, the Tea Party still has him by the tail, and he can't. So those who want even a vote on immigration reform, I assume people listening have a diverse view of opinions. I always say, well, why don't we just vote then? See what happens. Let the majority win. Forget about it until after the election. And do you think if we have a narrowly Republican Senate in 2015 and John Boehner only picks up, you know, a modest amount of seats in the House, will the Republicans have the liberty, feel like they have the freedom to do it next year? Or will they still feel constrained by their conservative base? So if you want legislative action on this issue, you might be waiting a very long time. So the big question remains then, what will the president do with his executive powers after the election? But you're going to have to wait.
I want to get to that whole prognostication about what is going to happen in the Senate with whatever you said, 56 days to go, John King. But just staying for a second, if you were sitting one-on-one off the record with Barack Obama and he was in a wildly truthful, self-aware moment, would he acknowledge to you that he made a mistake by not filing his own legislation and so that essentially the public knew where he stood, even if he didn't have the votes for it to pass, or would he not?
I don't know. I don't know. When I've been at this a long time, and one of the things I try not to do is to read minds. I understand his argument. They would have just picked it apart, and they never would have voted on it, or you know, they would have made Democrats vote for it and then undermined it somehow and used those votes against the Democrats. I get all that. In the game of political chess, it would have probably been a liability to actually put your ideas on paper, knowing they were going to fail. I get that part. But I come back to the basic thing, then why did you promise to do it? Because you should, if you're running for president, you got a pretty good, and you and people around you have a pretty good understanding of politics. And that dynamic I just laid out about having it used against you was true when he made the promise, just as true when he made the promise as to when he didn't keep it. And so why make the promise? And so then you can say, well, the promise was, you know, cynical politics. And again, we don't read minds. We need to be careful. But he said what he said. And when politicians are held accountable for what they said, all politicians, you know, that's, so be it. I think that's the way it's supposed to be.
Speaking of pretty good understanding, I think Margie and I would agree the two people who have the best understanding of where the voters in this country are you and Nate Silver. Nate Silver the other day, Nate Silver is the guy who, while he was wrong on the World Cup final and then some, I think has called 50 out of 50 states in the last two presidential elections. Silver said the other day, and I'm sure you know this, John, somewhere in the neighborhood of 64% or 2-1 odds that the Republicans take control of the United States Senate. Do you agree with them?
Yeah, and if the election were held today, I'd actually boost it up a little higher than that. But we've got 8 weeks, and things can change. But I think if we have a big debate about is this a wave election, and people shy away from waves because there aren't as many competitive House districts anymore because of how they've drawn the line. So even if the Republicans have a great night on election night from the House perspective, they probably gain 15 to 18 seats. So people say, well, that's not a wave because the average in the six-year midterm election is 25 seats. So you see no wave. But if you want to define wave as will Republicans get the Senate, does that make this a wave election? Look, right now they're going to win West Virginia. They're going to win South Dakota. They're going to win Montana. That gives them three of the six they need. It looks like they're going to hold Kentucky and Georgia as we speak today. Those are still in play, and we have to keep an eye on Kansas. So then if that's the case, Republicans hold where their incumbents are up, and they get the three I just gave you, those are Democratic seats, then they need just three more. So you have a list of Louisiana, Arkansas, North Carolina.
Is New Hampshire on that list?
I was just about to put it there. So okay. If you just do the red states first, North Carolina, Alaska, Louisiana, Arkansas. All right, they need three more. There's four targets right there. And then you bring in Iowa and New Hampshire, where the Democrats are ahead, but only by single digits. And then if you do get – if the trend in polling that we have seen over the last 7 to 10 days, if that trend continues, a lot of Democrats are nervous that Michigan and even Minnesota could come into play. And so if let's say you have six or seven races on Election Day that will decide control of the Senate and Republicans need half of them, well, in a midterm election year, which the president's approval rating is at 40-something percent, 42, 43, and two-thirds of the American people think the country's heading in the wrong direction, just go back and look at history. Republicans are going to win more than half of the close races on Election Day. That's just how it works. You know, Democrats won way more than half in 2006 when it was their year. Republicans won way more than half in 2010 when it was their year. This is a little bit different. It's a kind of a cranky year because people are mad at everybody. But so are the Republicans going to win 75%? Maybe not. But are they going to win 50 to 55%, which is all they're probably going to need on Election Day? That's where my money would go.
Okay, so since you did Nostradamus Part 1, you'll leave us with Nostradamus Part 2, Dorchester boy. Patriots will be undefeated this season, don't you think?
That's funny. That's very, very funny. I watched that second half, and words I thought I had reserved only for Red Sox were coming out of my mouth.
I hope that little baby of yours wasn't around, John King.
I think the consensus up here is that Tom Brady's going to shave the beard.
Is that what it is?
Doesn't do well with the beard, yeah.
The little guy was in the backyard building a teepee. He did not hear my non-family-friendly words. But you know what? Hope springs eternal, and go Bruins.
We knew it. John King.
I should point out. Crackstaff says he already has shaved the beard.
So is that true?
Yes.
Well, thank you, Crackstaff. Hey, John King, good luck tonight.
With Giselle's approval. No
I would assume
oh,
so.
No doubt.
John, good to talk to you. Good luck tonight with Primary Night.
Thank you. John King is CNN's chief national correspondent. He hosts Inside Politics, which you can catch Sunday morning at 8:30. Okay, up next, Peter Kazis will be joining us for Election Day coverage. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And we're making Election Day, we're marking Election Day, I should say, here at WGBH. Throughout the day, through the evening, obviously, on GBH Radio and on TV, we'll be covering the races. Here with us in Studio 3 for an election night forecast is WGBH's senior online editor. That would be Peter Kazis. Hello there, Peter.
Great to be here,
Hello,
guys.
Peter Kazis. So Jim Browdy was bragging at the top of the show that he'd already gone to vote.
Bragging.
He has his little sticker stuck to his
Me
phone.
Me too.
Okay. So you vote in Dorchester, I assume. No, you vote in Jamaica Plain.
Jamaica Plain.
So was it crowded at the polls?
No, but it doesn't count in the way. I'm always one of the first four or five people, and as usual, the first four or five people who are usually there, the head of the Carpenters Union, a lawyer, me, my wife, Sue, you know, it's a race to see who gets there.
What are we hearing? So
I didn't ask you. Was it crowded in Cambridge?
Yeah, there were two of us. It was huge. It was like we were elbow.
Wow.
It was sort of like that derby. What's that thing where you go?
Kentucky derby?
Roller derby.
Roller derby.
We're trying this woman Ruth and I were trying to elbow each other out so that we could be. No, same deal. Actually, I take it back. Often in really controversial kinds of things, high profile races where there's a fevered feeling. The place pretty crowded at 7 on the dot, but today it was not. You were looking at some of the Boston turnout numbers early on. We all know that Bill Galvin, Secretary of State, has been predicting as low as 15%, which is unthinkable, and as high as low 20s, which is pretty close to unthinkable.
Well, we're in the unthinkable range so far anyway. You know, the early morning voting, the latest numbers the city of Boston has shows 2.68 people have voted. A percent have voted.
That is really bad.
Now, those numbers are being retabulated as we speak, and in about an hour there'll be new ones.
As of what time was that, like 10 or something?
Yeah, that was late morning.
Okay.
Not surprisingly, the highest turnout so far has been in West Roxbury, Ward 20, the Boston's electoral breadbasket, if you will. With 4.36% of the voters. The runner-up was J.P. in Roslindale, Ward 19, about 4.27. And Boston Student Ghetto, Ward 21, Alston Brighton, has the lowest turnout so far at 1.37. But, you know, there is good news for someone in low turnout.
What?
The good news is potentially for all the women on the ballots. In any primary, well-educated women vote in disproportionate numbers. If that holds,
is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a rule of thumb for the last 30 years.
And Galvin says that a disproportionate number of absentee ballot requests have been made by women, which would also suggest that there's a higher turnout from women.
Yeah, I mean that could be. It is entirely possible. This is not a prediction. This is just speculation that Martha Coakley, Maura Healey, Deb Goldberg, and Susanna Bump may all make it to the final.
Well, you know, that would be really historic since we have been historically pretty bad about electing women statewide. And if Martha Coakley were to become the governor and Deb Goldberg were to become the treasurer, Healey, attorney general, can you imagine?
There's also a woman Republican running. Oh, that's right.
Is already the auditor.
Yep.
But so that would be like a total turnaround.
Well, New Hampshire has an all female congressional.
And I remember Arizona, which is mostly Republican, I'm going back now, it was at least 5 or 10 years ago, but they had all these Republican women running
Arizona. When Janet Napolitano was the governor, I think.
Yes, we've been kind of behind here in supposedly so progressive Massachusetts.
I wouldn't put the cart before the proverbial horse, though, in light of the fact that our history belies. I mean, despite what Peter's saying and Galvin is saying about the turnout, I believe our record is as bad, if not the single worst, in the United States on electing women. By the way, Callie Crossley just called down and said she voted in Cambridge at 8:30. There was only one other person who had voted. That is just unthinkable to me. So let's go to the other end of the day. You voted at 7. I voted at 7. Callie voted at 8:30. Marjorie's going to vote at the end of the show. Are we going to be up late tonight, or is this going to be one of these things where the stations, Associated Press, and others are calling all these elections early on?
I would be amazed if you know, we're not all in bed by 10 o'clock.
Even Healy Tolman, which is the only one that I think a lot of people think amongst the contested races could be close. Or Tierney and Moulton on the North Shore in Congress.
Tierney, Moulton, and Healy and Tolman. I mean, the Healy-Tolman race is interesting because Tolman is the arch-establishment candidate. He's got the governor behind him. He's got the mayor of Boston behind him. He has the AFL-CIO behind him.
Which should help him in a low turnout.
Which should help in a low turnout unless a lot of women come out. Those two things sort of cancel each other out. Moulton could go, but listen, the counting goes fast when there aren't a lot of ballots to count.
Yeah, that's really true. Does anybody even do paper ballots anymore? Remember when I was a young reporter, there were so many places that the paper ballots, you're up until
midnight. Can I tell you one place where they do
Fall
paper
Rivers
ballots,
and the
I believe?
And the Dighton? What?
Cambridge.
You're
we
kidding.
Circle, we fill in little circles.
Oh, proportional representation.
Yes, look at Marjorie with her mouth up. We're a throwback kind of community, Marjorie.
Gosh, I guess so.
Listen, I'll tell you, the ballots in Boston, not, to me, I mean, they're secure in terms of anyone tampering with them, but there's not a lot of privacy. I mean, they're color-coded to see which party you go to. I mean, almost anyone can see who you voted for, but...
Here's a little known fact I read in the Globe this morning.
What's that?
That Warren Tolman can speak a little bit of Armenian, a little bit of Greek, and a little bit of Portuguese.
Watertown is one of the most heavily Armenian cities. Is Watertown a city? I think it's a city.
I don't know, but that's pretty impressive.
In the United States of America. Yeah, it is. Hey, you know, one of the interesting things I think that will happen come the end of the primary season tonight is it is finally time, maybe, for the independents for governor to be in play. Now, and because they don't have primaries, for those who are thinking, what's the difference? But then we read Jeff McCormick, who amongst the three independents, there's Evan Falchuk, who's generally gotten low, 2-1 point in the polls. Scott Lively, who was here, who's the guy who's built his career on basically anti-gay organizing around the world, including in Uganda, places like that. The highest numbers is McCormick. We read he lost yet another staffer, Joe Malone, a former Republican who became an independent to work for him. Dan Payne and Todd Domke, Democrat and Republican consultants, had left the campaign. Are they going to be players? I don't mean come November elections. Are they going to be players over the next 50-some days? Or are the independents going to be seen as afterthoughts, Peter Kazis?
I think they're going to be seen as afterthoughts. They haven't. Listen, it's been hard. I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. It's been hard enough for mainstream candidates for important jobs like treasurer or unimportant jobs like lieutenant governor to get any traction, let alone these independent candidates. They had a lot of promise, but when your consultants desert you, it's not a good sign.
You know, you said something.
What's happened with McCormick, his consultants.
They were in it for the love of it. I mean, they're not there. There's no big money in that campaign.
Well, you might also argue that, in any case, so we'll find out what the McCormick thing is. But you said something interesting on Fox 25 this morning, Peter, that I hadn't thought about. I keep saying, and in fact, we've discussed this in studio here on air, how significant is it that Maura Healey is the first openly gay candidate who would be a statewide office holder. And you made the point this morning that there's another guy who's openly gay who's running for office for that unimportant position you described, lieutenant governor. Almost nobody talks about any of the candidates in that race. Occasionally Karen Pulido, because she was handpicked by Charlie Baker on the Republican side. But Steve Kerrigan is an openly gay candidate for lieutenant governor on the Democratic side. You don't hear about that at all.
You know, I wonder if some of it is, of course, it's easy to say no one cares about the lieutenant governor's race. But I think because he is he's a mainstream Democrat.
Yeah.
You know, he's a clubhouse Democrat. And I wonder if clubhouse Democrats don't count as gay. You know, they're not.
What do you mean, in the minds of the electorate? Or you're saying
in the minds of in the minds of the activists.
No, it's not about that. It's about the fact that Healy, in my opinion, Healy and Tolman has been really high profile, and nobody cares about the lieutenant governor's race.
Hold on, I'm confused. Are you talking about nobody cares about the lieutenant governor's race, or nobody cares about the fact that a gay guy is running for lieutenant governor?
Well, he is suggesting, Peter is, that it may be the latter. I am suggesting it's because nobody cares about or knows, which is a real problem in light of the fact that in recent years, we have had one governor who left to become ambassador to Mexico, which never happened, Bill Weld. One governor leave to be ambassador to Canada, which was Paul Cellucci, which did happen. Deval Patrick, even though he said he wasn't interested, allegedly being considered for serious positions. It is pathetic that we have independent elections of lieutenant governor candidates who no one has ever heard of, who are literally and one job or one heartbeat away from being the chief executive of Massachusetts. And I'm telling you, if you stopped 10 people in the street and said, who are the Democrats and Republican running for lieutenant governor, 9.5 of them would have absolutely no idea.
That's why better off not having lieutenant governor.
Or so having the governor.
If the governor were to leave, you could have either a special election or something else to
replace
him.
You do it like presidents do, and like Charlie Baker did, you pick your running mate because you're really voting for the man or woman at the top. Let him or her decide who they feel comfortable. What happens if it turns out, and we've had this in our history in the state, when somebody is elected governor and the person elected to run. A couple of years ago, do you remember Jim Rappaport was running for lieutenant governor? Mitt Romney couldn't stand him, and he picked Curry Healey and campaigned for Curry Healey. And the question was, what if Jim Rappaport becomes lieutenant governor and he and Romney, the governor, don't talk to each other?
Well, you are obsessed with this lieutenant governor
Jim.
And I'm not really clear because I'm not clear besides chairing the governor's council, which no one wants to
I'll tell you what it is. They become governor the governor leaves.
But I'm saying I think we'd be better off not even having one because I don't think that the state of Massachusetts – I mean, maybe you've missed that Tim Murray's no longer around to be the lieutenant governor.
The fact that there is no backup in a special election is not a good idea. Because Massachusetts, I think one reason...
Yeah, the Secretary of State, Bill Galvin, can step in and run the whole place.
I'd love to see that.
By the way, I got a good email from a voter from Cambridge, Bob. He says, I'm registered as an independent. Young poll worker looked at me trying to figure out what to do because he's an independent. Finally, she asked, what denomination?
That's a great
pretty good.
So, Peter, tomorrow morning, the likelihood, I mean, if the polls are right, and we have no idea, Charlie Baker and Martha Coakley, if the polls hold true, are the nominees. What's the first salvo from Baker about Coakley, and what's the first Coakley or Grossman or Berwick salvo about Baker?
Well, I think Martha would probably be wisest to take a shot at Charlie's real Achilles heel, which is the way women view him. I think it's not particularly fair, but he comes off as a big stiff. Women don't find him a sympathetic character. And I would take a shot in that general direction.
What's he do?
What's he do? He just paints her as a clubhouse Democrat, you know, a creature of the legislature, you know, who's done nothing to root out political corruption in the state.
You know what it seems to me would be if I were running Charlie Baker's campaign, I would say the best thing is the competence, because he could point to fixing the things that Deval Patrick has not fixed, and there are any number of those. And missteps in the AG's office. I mean, isn't that a compelling argument if you're sort of, worried about things like the Department of Children and Families falling apart?
What missteps is he going to list from the – what AG managerial missteps is he going to highlight?
Well, I think a lot of people think that Martha Coakley has not prosecuted she should have and that the prosecution she has prosecuted have not turned out very well.
See, I think the subtext of this election is going to be that there are a lot of people, many of whom voted for Deval Patrick, who just think it's time for a change. The Democrats have such a hammerlock on the legislature. Deval has been pretty ineffective his last 2 years. He appears
still wildly popular.
Which is amazing. Master politician.
Yeah.
And by the way, he might be wildly popular because he's somewhat disengaged. People don't like politics. That's one reason Bill Weld was so popular. You know, no one held it against Bill Weld that he went off and played squash, that he, went boar hunting or drank amber-colored liquid and played poker every week. They thought that was a sign of being healthy.
We know it's interesting the way Deval Patrick said so many times about things. I don't have to have an opinion on everything. And I don't know, maybe that appeals to people as well, that he stays out of the fray in certain areas.
I think starting a discussion that is endless, I think part of the reason, even if people say, well, the medical marijuana rollout has been a problem and the DCF thing has been a problem.
And the health connector.
But not many people accuse him of being corrupt or any of those kinds of things. And so I think the fact that he is such a good presenter of issues and the fact that there's no allegation of corruption helps him. We only have a minute left, but
one thing, economy's good too.
That's another that's good right. point. One last thing before you go. We often forget to talk about our former senator who would like to be the next senator from New Hampshire. Scott Brown's running in a Republican primary. He is believed to be beating this guy, Jim Rubens, and former United States Senator Bob Smith. Do you get the sense there's resentment in Republican ranks that Brown has acted almost as if the Republican primary is an unnecessary pain in the behind because he's really running against Gene Shaheen, not running for the Republican nomination?
There's resentment among the hardcore, and I would say we'll be able to measure that resentment. If you establish 50% as a base mark, how much of the Republican vote does Scott Brown get? But I'll tell you, I have my wife's from New Hampshire. I've been talking to relatives of hers, and at first people were opposed to him because he was a carpetbagger. Now they've moved on to that great New Hampshire phrase, well, we don't know him well enough yet. That's the interim step to perhaps embracing him. You know, the elites of all the parties don't matter anymore. I mean, he's within 5 points of Gene Shaheen, and he may break the female stranglehold on the congressional delegation. We've got a long way to go, though.
So men are always crazy about Scott Brown, too. Half of them were in love with him here in Massachusetts, including Jim.
No, that is totally untrue. I had a relationship with him. Let's just leave it at that.
Certainly
before
did.
You go, so we'll be asleep by 10 o'clock. Is that correct? I want to hold you
I
to
hope
it.
So.
Okay, fine. Peter Kadzis, is great to see you as always.
Thank you very much, Peter Kadzis. Peter Kadzis is WGBH's senior online editor. Thanks again, Peter, for coming in. Up next, as ISIS continues to dominate the national international stage, Boko Haram is still at large. A new frontline documentary reminds us of the havoc they're wreaking across Nigeria. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. While most of the world's attention has been turned to ISIS, another militant Islamist movement continues to kill innocent civilians.
Boko Haram has been beheading police officers, setting off bombs, and killing schoolchildren.
They burn schools like the Taliban. They kill government officials and attack military and police locations like the Taliban. They see themselves as Taliban of Nigeria.
That's from the new Frontline documentary with the fight against Boko Haram, the Islamist militant group that kidnapped, as you recall, nearly 300 Nigerian schoolgirls in April. Joining us in Studio 3 is the producer of this documentary, Evan Williams. Evan went to Nigeria in May right after Boko Haram set off 2 car bombs in Jos. It's a city in central Nigeria. Evan, the thing is incredibly powerful, and it's really good to meet you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much for being here. So a lot of us focused on this terrible incident in April when these schoolgirls were kidnapped. And we remember John Kerry talking about what a horrible crime this was. And we were going to go after these people. I had no idea of what went on between April and now in terms of the government that we thought was going to be capturing these people. What is the government doing? That's a lot of what your film captures.
It is exactly that. And I think you're absolutely right. It's completely fallen off not only the news headlines, but also, I'd say, the agenda of the Nigerian government and possibly that of the US and other Western governments who made all that noise after the Bring Back Our Girls campaign started so vigorously. It's completely dropped off for 2 reasons. One is they can't simply go and rescue the girls because Boko Haram has separated them into different groups, we believe. And if there is a rescue attempt, they could all possibly be killed. That's one big problem they've got. But the main problem really is that the government in Nigeria doesn't really seem that committed to trying to solve the problem of Boko Haram or to really, in an effective way, negotiate the release of those girls because they don't really take the problem seriously enough.
Well, I would have to say, as the guy who made this film, Evan, that is the understatement of the century. When you watch this, I assumed, as did Marjorie, that Boko Haram were the bad guys. The government and the government-supported militia are as vicious and as focused on slaughter of the people as Boko Haram is. Is that not a fair statement?
That is exactly what we found. I mean, over the past year, we've been collecting videotape, or I should say digital clips that have been filmed on the mobile phones of the pro-government militia and the soldiers engaged in trying to find Boko Haram and hunt them. what these videos showed us was the abuse, torture, beating, and executions of young men that they accuse of being supporters of Boko Haram on very, very thin evidence. And in the end, what we've discovered is that there's no evidence at all that many of these men are innocent. They then get beaten, tortured, and handed over to the military and are disappearing in military detention. In fact, a recent story indicated there could be as many people killed by the military as are being killed by Boko Haram up there right now.
How did you get these videos? Why do people trust you? I mean, these videos are so powerful and so frightening. Why were you trusted to be given these things?
Originally, we heard of a clip that was showing Boko Haram training children as suicide bombers. And that's what we were going for. In the end, I sent up a trusted journalist colleague in Nigeria to go and find that video. He couldn't find that. He sent me instead the original 8 videos, which showed the torture, beating, and execution of accused Boko Haram members, many of whom were innocent. So I started thinking there is something here that we should investigate, and we then set up a network of trusted people to try and get as many videos as possible. The interesting new social media aspect of this is these clips are being shared by these young men as trophies of their campaign. So they're out there, but you just need to know who to get to get them.
You know, I know you're not a psychiatrist, but you were over there in Nigeria getting this, doing this incredible work. I'm looking at this last night and saying, okay, we know Boko Haram, they have an agenda, but then you have the militia that's supposedly a part of the government, or is part of the government. They're taking people that are like themselves, that grew up in this country, young men, some of them look barely teenagers, and torturing them. What is the mindset there? They're gathering up these young men by the hundreds, as you say, with very little evidence that they have done anything wrong, beating them to death in front of their parents. What's happening?
I think it's a classic psychological situation where a militia has been given the ability to go and detain anybody they like on the basis of whatever they feel like. And then it's not their responsibility. So therefore, they can say, well, we were told to do this by the army. We're just doing our job. The problem is there's no accountability, there's no control, they're not trained, they shouldn't be doing this in the first place. And the militia doing this means that you've got excesses. So they beat them up and then they say to me, because I've interviewed 2 militia members about what's going on, they say the only way to get the truth is to beat them until they scream, as they say in the film. And I say to them, guys, the problem here is torture, but they don't seem to admit, or they don't want to admit, that that's a problem. They think they're catching them because the machine now needs to be self-fulfilling because they're getting paid by the army and by the state government to perform these acts.
By the way, that's the voice of Evan Williams, who's the producer of this incredibly powerful documentary. Speaking of the militia, here's a man who goes by the name of Muhammad, and he is one of the proud members of the militia, which says they're hunting for Boko Haram.
We tie their hands and legs and place them in the sun. We beat them with a stick until they scream. Then they tell us everything. If he has killed someone or has a gun, he will tell us. He will tell us if he is Boko Haram. He will tell us everything.
I found a witness, a local school teacher, who said he looked on in horror as more and more of the town's young men were accused of being terrorists, even though he had seen the Boko Haram fighters fleeing before the military arrived.
How does the average Nigerian who's in the midst of this know who to trust or believe? Or is the answer, trust no one? I mean,
that's exactly the point. And in fact, one of the main reasons for us doing the story was the more we looked into it, the more we found people absolutely desperate to have a voice about what was going on in the north. We interviewed, for example, 4 women, who 3 of whom their husbands had gone missing, and 1, 2 brothers. They were picked up two years, 4 months ago when the military did a sweep through their area. They have not been seen since. And when they go to the military to try and find their men and say he's just a butcher or a baker or whatever, he's not a member of Boko Haram, the army accused them of being Boko Haram and threatened to shoot them. So the problem is there's nowhere for people to go. So there's a lot of desperate people who feel trapped between a rock and a hard place, between Boko Haram and the savagery of the military.
When John Kerry, in the initial part of your documentary, says whatever he says, we're counting on the government to help us find these kids and it's unconscionable and all that, does he know what you now know after having done this, and he's trying to put international pressure on the government, or is he not aware of how every part of this triangle, militia, government, Boko Haram, are killers.
The U.S. State Department told me that they would like to do more to be engaged with the Nigerian military in combating Boko Haram because, as you said, Marjorie, you know, this creates a problem for us in the future if we don't deal with it. The problem is that the Americans, I think the U.S. State Department does know what's been going on up there, and a former ambassador, John Campbell, told me that basically they have been aware of this. What the videos confirm is what they've been hearing from several sources over a period of months. And in fact, John Kerry made a very strong public statement in May last year saying that they were aware of gross human rights violations by the military. But the videos bring it out into the public and you can see it for the first time from the front line. It's a real window into a hidden war.
Here's the former ambassador to Nigeria that Evan just mentioned, John Campbell, on how the Nigerian military are handling villagers suspected of belonging to Boko Haram.
The people detained are not formally charged. They're not brought before a magistrate. They appear to be selected for detention in a more or less random way. Government security services must be held to a much higher standard than a brutal insurgency. A much higher standard.
You know, Evan Williams, brutal is a perfect segue here, brutal insurgency. I would ask you this anyway, but in the wake of the Sotloff and Foley executions, how much personal danger were you in doing this thing?
Personally, not a great deal.
Why?
We operated in a way where there were certain areas we didn't go to in northern Nigeria because the roads are often attacked by Boko Haram. And basically, if you're a white guy, to be frank, in the back of a car, you're going to be picked up and taken as a hostage for money or possibly for the same reason to be beheaded on YouTube. We also operated in a way for the ultimate safety of the people we were interviewing, because if we go deeply into the areas, into their villages and their towns where a white, frankly, TV crew turns up, we're going to be noticed and there's going to be questions to them about who you're talking to. So we made a lot of organizational situations occur where we brought people to us in a reasonably safe area. But I must say, Nigeria, northern Nigeria, anything can happen at any time.
Yeah, did you have, I assume you had lots of bodyguards with you.
No, certainly not.
You did not?
No, that would be too high a profile. It was myself and a cameraman, Danny Bogardo, who did an excellent job, and one local fixer, because basically we wanted to keep a very low profile. If you start traveling around with too many people, you're going to raise questions.
How long were you there?
We were there 16 days all up.
So you were you managed in those 16 days to get people to hand over these videos to you, to manage to get people to interview that people will see on the broadcast.
The videos we've been collecting for over a year.
Okay.
Yeah, but so we had the core video material, but we went through a very strict verification process because you don't know what those videos are. So we had to go through and actually check everything that we were using in the film. We then wanted two eyewitnesses at least to every event we used in the film. And then we talked to witnesses, we talked to victims, survivors, and then the militia members themselves who gave us those videos so we could actually say with certainty that what we're seeing is northern Nigeria, it's now, and it's real.
You know, Evan Williams, beyond the quality of this this work you did, the importance of it, when the world is focused on ISIS, understandably, the world has been focused on what's going on in Gaza. I assume if we were to talk to fellow media members or members of the government and say, why hasn't this become a priority when it was allegedly a priority in April off the girls, they'd say, well, there's so much going on in the world, we're going to get to this. I mentioned to you, I interviewed Walter Carrington and his wife. Walter Carrington was the ambassador to Nigeria from 93 to 97 for Bill Clinton. His wife is a doctor who is Nigerian. And I said, this is a couple of months ago, this Bring Back Our Girls thing, which even Michelle Obama held up, the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls, sort of like yesterday's news. Mm. Is it yesterday's news? And I guess I'd say to you, is all of this slaughter yesterday's news because of the color of the skin of these young girls? I mean, basically saying to them, if these 300 kids were all little white kids, white girls, we wouldn't have forgotten this. And to their credit, both former Ambassador Carrington and his wife, Dr. Carrington, said, yes. Is that your sense as to why the world seems to have forgotten Nigeria?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. If there had been 300 white girls, they would have probably been rescued within the first week. Nothing would have been spared to get them back.
So what happens here?
I think what we reveal in our film is partly, it reveals partly the problem. Western powers, particularly the US, want to be more engaged with the Nigerian military in combating Boko Haram. so does France and the UK, for that matter. The problem is when you see in the video what they're doing, how they're treating people up there, how they're conducting this campaign, I think Western powers are well aware that if you get too close to these guys, if you get too far in bed in, without some serious reform, without accountability, without investigations into the acts that we see in the videos, then you're in bed with a very dangerous force, which is actually, if anything, strengthening the insurgency. Because people have told us, if your village is attacked by this militia, and in one case in the film in Burma, where 35 men were killed, then the next village is going to side with the insurgency. It's a brutal war up there. And I don't for any moment want to support Boko Haram. They are brutal extremists. They will kill you as soon as they will look at you. And they've been killing school children and police officers. That's not the issue. The issue is the way the state's conducting it. And I think it gets back to your question. Why has the Chibok situation not been resolved more readily? Partly because of the way the military operates.
And what could be done from outside powers to, I mean, is there something that we should be doing?
I think the people we spoke to and the people we meet in the film were very keen to try and get the message across that what they want above all is, first of all, some sort of accountability for the way the military operates. And in that way, to possibly bring about a more just campaign against Boko Haram. Nobody wants to join Boko Haram that we met. No families want to join Boko Haram. It's more the fact that they feel completely powerless against their own military. Not only powerless, but terrified of their own army.
I'll tell you, you've really shone light on this darkness, Evan.
It is an absolute really incredible piece of work and a disturbing piece of work, but a really important piece of work. Evan Williams, thank you very much
for being with us.
Evan Williams produced the new Frontline documentary about the hunt for Boko Haram. Tonight, Frontline is airing a two-part special in a two-part hour special on the biggest stories coming out of Africa, the Ebola outbreak on and the fight against Boko Haram. It airs right here on WGBH tonight at 10, Channel 2. For more shows, Times, check your local PBS station for listings. And again, Evan, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Up next, Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us to talk about procrastination. Is postponing the inevitable good for inspiration and creativity, or is it just a really perverse and self-destructive way to waste time? That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Joining us, as she does every Tuesday for Open Mic, is Nancy Kane. Nancy is an historian at the Harvard Business School. She holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, it's great to see you.
It's great to be here.
Now, before we jump into today's discussion, you want to hear my all-time
favorite?
Let's
just wait.
No.
Let's not do it. Let's just wait. We can do something else with this time.
She stepped on my punchline, but
very
it's true.
Good.
Okay, that's the topic for today. The good, the bad, and the ugly of procrastination, from the dread and guilt and self-loathing that comes with it to the creativity and very ripe fruits of our labor that can be the result of putting things off until the very last moment. Hi there, Nancy.
Hey there.
Okay, we have read many stories about procrastinating in preparation for your visit, and the conventional wisdom is that it's terrible. But one of these guys said, "That's baloney. It's good for you. We should wait and wait and wait." Now,
to the very last minute.
Exactly. What do you think, Nancy Kane?
I think it's poppycock. And I think the article that we read about the book, by the way, dear listener, is Wait: The Art and Science of Delay, by a University of San Diego professor, Frank Partnoy, Partnoy. The Smithsonian Magazine, you can get online, has an article about it, and the writer, Megan Gambino, is a procrastinator, so she's really excited about the book. She kind of waxes rhapsodic about it through this short, shall we say, very breezy review. I think it's poppycock, and I think it's another example. We've talked about this at other moments in our conversations of people creating topics to get attention rather than because there's really a there. So,
well, wait, before you just sort of summarily dismiss him, let's dismiss him on the merits if you want to. For people who haven't read this thing, he basically says, first thing you should do is figure out what your deadline is. How long do you have to do something? Right. If you conclude at 60 minutes, you should wait till the 59th minute to do it. And he says the evidence of this is, look at the greatest tennis players in the world. They're not fast. fast like you think they are, he says. They're slow, just like great hitters. They wait to the absolute last millisecond. So why is his alleged evidence BS?
Because I think that kind of evidence, I was struck by that reading this article and several others, which I'm sure we'll get to. I think that evidence doesn't really apply to most everyday procrastination and most of us. Most of us aren't professional tennis players.
Exactly.
Most of us aren't military planners waiting to the last possible minute before we pull the trigger on a bomb raid, right? There are different instances where gathering more information, including how close the ball is to you or how fast it's coming, which you often can't discern when it's a ways away and you need those extra milliseconds, those are not necessarily grounds to generalize from. And they obtain in very, very specific circumstances. The bulk of procrastination, as we experience it, as it's been studied, as it's been written about, is about all kinds of tasks in everyday life, from the creative, I need to be working on this book chapter, P.S. academics know a lot about this, to, oh, you know, I probably better get my tax return and figure out what's going on with my taxes before, you know, April 14th at midnight, to, you know, I have a real issue with one of the people on my team at work, and I need to talk to that person about this issue. So, you know, procrastination, as we're talking about it, studying it, comes in a whole bunch of forms that aren't as dramatic and aren't as context specific as the examples that Mr. Frank Portnoy is talking about.
So what's the evidence that he's wrong and that you're right, that it's a bad thing, which we've all grown up believing, even though, and I'll tell you in a few minutes, I am probably the worst procrastinator who has ever walked this planet.
Everyone says that. It's interesting.
No, people, horrible. People,
and I think there's something of the, like, you know, when we talk about procrastination, it releases us all to tell, you know, to kind of come clean, if you will, and then we assuage the guilt, by the way, that's part of the scientific evidence about why procrastination is costly. So, dear listeners, the article that answers Jim's question in a very pithy way is an article called Why Wait? The Science Behind Procrastination by a writer named Eric Jaffe, just like it sounds, in Psychology Today. It's online and it's very, very good. And it's meaty because it's Psychology Today. So we got lots of different examples. The most important example is about, well, there are two kind of bodies of evidence. One is about studying the emotional responses of people who procrastinate. So guess what? It may feel good today to say, no, I'm not going to work on that paper. But it feels a lot worse when it's the night before it's due or three hours before
absolutely.
It's due and you're working on it. There's also
the stress level from that is so immense you feel like your body could explode. I could not agree
absolutely.
More.
Absolutely. And you know you haven't given it and yourself a fair shot at doing well. So the evidence that's cited in this article from very, very esteemed scientists, psychologists, some economists, et cetera, is that the emotional cost of procrastinating is very, very high. There are also all these practical or, if you will, empirical costs, which are, guess what? People who procrastinate don't tend to do as well on the things they set out to do. The tasks aren't, unlike the tennis ball coming at Annie Roddick or Mr. Federer, or unlike the bombing scenario or the bombing planning, right? Those examples are unique. Most tasks that we procrastinate on, we don't deliver on as well. And anyone that's thought about any kind of issue with another human being, where you have something that's important, right? Be it a marital issue, an issue with your child, an issue with someone you work with, an issue with an aging relative, like, hey, we really need to nail down how we're going to pay for my mother's assisted living before she needs assisted living, just
right.
to give you an example. Or, hey, we really need to start salting away money in our 401k. Anyone that's been in those kind of situations knows that the longer you wait, ironically, the smaller the window of opportunity to do something about, to accomplish the objective that you're setting out to accomplish on the task that you're procrastinating
on. Yeah, but Nancy, my take on this, I've actually thought a lot about this through the years, long before we read what you suggested we do. And half of me agrees with you, meaning I understand the stress. I understand the anxiety. Putting your 401k planning early or for your mother's whatever makes total sense. Let's talk about creativity for a minute.
Yeah.
I'll just talk about myself.
Okay.
If I try to do something in advance that either Marjorie and I have to do together or have to write something, I can tell you without exception, I am far cleverer when I have a deadline that is minutes or hours away than I am if we sit down 3 days in advance and say, let's plot out what we're going to do with Nancy Kane next Tuesday, almost without exception. So is it possible that some procrastination works and some doesn't?
Well, it is possible. Dear listeners, there's another great article if you're interested in this topic and you want to kind of follow the tea leaves. James Sururwiecki, who many of you will know as the business correspondent, the business writer for The New Yorker, has a great column
this
from 2010. It's not his typical column. It's a longer column. Let me give you the title. It's called Later, October 11th, 2010. And he suggests and summarizes some of the science. A couple of things to pick up on what Jim's talking about. First, There is some empirical evidence that that just like Jim said, we battle with different demons or different voices in our head. So part of me says, no, we should get on this project we're going to deal with Nancy with, and we should gather some evidence and think about it. Another part of me says, no, it'll be better if I have a deadline. And it's entirely possible, and this goes all the way back to the Greeks talking about a term excuse me, I'm just going to get this right. My Greek isn't so good. A term they call...
call William Bulger on the phone. Oh.
Akrasia.
What does that mean?
Which means, strictly speaking, we're not actually acting in a good self-regulating way. We're not really kind of being good stewards of ourselves, right? And we have different voices, some of which are on this sometimes being good stewards and some of which are not. So Jim's explanation for procrastination about internal debate is entirely consonant, not only with the Greeks and Plato and Socrates, but with recent scientific work on it. Second, deadlines unequivocally help procrastinators and non-procrastinators. You know, Samuel Johnson once said, nothing so focuses a man's thoughts but the prospect of hanging. So some of what you're talking about is about that prospect. Many years ago when I was writing my first book, I worked with a very talented editor and Pulitzer Prize winner named Thomas McCraw, who's a historian at the Harvard Business School. He used to give me deadlines on a very regular basis, small amounts of copy, large amounts of copy. And man, I really got it together in the runway up to the deadline. So no question, deadlines matter. The larger question you raise, am I better, right, if I'm working really, really close to the wire? I think the evidence is much more complicated than I know I'm better. You may indeed be better. The larger both time series and qualitative evidence has more ambiguity in it than that, Jim.
You know, I spent my lifetime writing on deadlines for newspapers where you had to get your story in by 7 o'clock or you were toast. And what I found is if something happens, it's a breaking news story, and you have to begin at 6 o'clock, your concentration is so intense,
and
your focus is so intense because you either get it in by seven legibly and correctly, or as I say, you're toast. But if you have the story done at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and you have it, your deadline is seven, it will take you 5 hours to do what you would do in 45 minutes between 6 and 7.
Yeah.
But you know what? I think you always are going to have a better product if it takes you 5 hours to do
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. We all know
There's no question about it. And going back, and I had a chance because I'm working at the Globe now and I have a little more flexibility in my deadlines. I went back and rewrote something I wrote a week ago. And I think
so
I improved it by about 50%.
Right.
But one last thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I thought about this a lot. I think one of the things about procrastination is that it's a great excuse. And you could say, you know, if I only had those 5 hours, I would have written something really brilliant.
Well, it does give you a way out. And there's a lot. And for people that have real, really huge kind of daily functioning issues in the Alzheimer's world, we talk about activities of daily living, right? ADLs who have procrastination problems with ADLs, right? It gives them that. But we know, again, from lots of different kinds of research on human beings, not on rats, right, that the stress
is huge. Yeah,
and
huge.
And always within us, the voice saying, I could have done better if I had 5 hours, but I chose not to take those 5 hours. So I think this is a big deal. Many years ago, when I was a graduate student, a colleague of mine at the Harvard History Department was working for a publication called Lingua Franca. It was kind of a New Yorker for academics. So you got to wonder about the procrastination, both of the people that read it and the people that wrote it, because they were reading it while they weren't working on their manuscripts. Anyway, one of the writers interviewed a time management expert, and she said something really interesting. P.S., dear listeners, most of the recent research suggests that procrastination is more of a psychological, emotional issue than it is a time management issue. Nonetheless, listen to this. She said there are four kinds of issues. There are issues that are urgent and unimportant. There are issues that are urgent and important. There are issues that are non-urgent and important, and there are issues that are non-urgent and unimportant. Guess which we put off, whether we're more likely to procrastinate in general or not. We put off over and over and over non-urgent, important stuff. So, oh. God, God, we really should talk about what we're going to do about my mom. Or, gosh, we really need to gear up for thinking about moving the kids, this child, into some kind of tutoring relationship. Or, gosh, we really should start planning, if we think we're going to sell our house next year, and how we're going to put it out in the market. We put off all kinds of non-urgent and important stuff. So just ask yourself, dear listeners, how you fit on those categories. I do all this coaching work. Every single manager I've ever worked with raises their hand and says, I got a lot of important and non-urgent stuff. I'm just pushing under the rug at the office.
Okay, I want to get to your coaching capacity, because I am convinced from the two of you that I should be coached into being less of a procrastinator. But before I get to that, since you told a story, let me tell one that Marjorie can relate to. I have probably 20,000 emails that I have not erased, and probably 1,000 of them deserve response. And the problem is, when you wait too long, you feel, well, can I really respond? It's so embarrassing that I haven't done it.
Yeah.
It weighs on you, etc. We used to have a boss at our former radio station who had a desk. When you walk in, you would know this. There was not one item on his desk except his computer, totally clean. There was not one email in his email. What he would say is, I read the email the second it comes in. If it turns out it's not important, I immediately erase it. If it is important, then it's important enough to respond to immediately. And then it is done with.
Yeah.
He had such an organized life. So that's one distinction. I think many more people can relate to me. So tell me how I change this. Is it self-imposed deadlines like that Pulitzer Prize winning editor of yours
I think
on you?
Deadlines,
so you have little deadlines along the way?
But they can't be self-imposed.
No, self-imposed,
it turns
out, with chronic and very, very serious procrastinators actually doesn't really help.
You mean they need to be externally imposed.
They need to be
imposed.
External.
You have to have the guillotine over your neck.
Yep. So Jonathan Franzen, who many of our listeners will recognize as
local
an award-winning author of Corrections, you may not know that he's an avid bird watcher, and he lives, I believe, north of L.A. on the coast, where he gets great access to birds to watch. And he built himself a house outside his house, a hut, with no windows, or if there are windows, they're blackened over, and no internet connection. And this is why I raised this, because I think we're actually living in an age in which putting off all the non-urgent, important stuff is actually getting much, much easier, because the email makes us, or email or the internet makes us feel distracted and urgent. Like, we'll do this and we'll take care of it. We'll type a few more tweets. That'll help us get ready for the story. We will do anything but the thing we know we should be doing. P.S., that internal Geiger counter is very, very useful, because all of us know when you pick up something you've been putting off and actually start doing it, this huge rush, right, of relief. It's like your first cup of coffee in the morning. It's this huge rush of relief and self-satisfaction that you've taken the first small step towards something you want to be doing.
It's hugely satisfying. Even if it's a small thing in your life, if it's been nagging you and it's been lying there forever,
absolutely,
when it's done, it is amazing.
I cleaned
amazing.
The closet out.
No, really?
I feel so good. You feel like Rocky, right, running up the steps of the Philadelphia Art Museum, pumping his arms and drinking the raw eggs. So we know this inside. But external deadlines help. You may need to be like Jonathan Franzen and get away from the internet access. I read in one of these stories about a program called Freedom that I believe a college student or graduate student in the South pioneered. It's free, that 75,000 people have downloaded, that will let you set your computer or your smartphone not to have internet access for up to 8 hours. So you can think about whether you need, shall we say, some other external help. I think it's a lot about, in my coaching work, small steps. You take the first small step, and that is incredibly empowering, and it actually fuels you to take the next step on the task or the issue or the relationship that you want, the non-urgent, important thing you want to be doing.
I'm not laughing at you, by the way. One of my favorite movies that Marjorie thinks is wildly unfunny is What About Bob?
Oh, What About Bob?
Where Andrew Dreyfus is the shrink and Bill Murray is the patient, and he's got real
problems. Not Andrew Dreyfus, it's somebody else.
No, Andrew Dreyfus is head of Blue Cross Blue Shield. Richard Dreyfus, excuse me.
It's an interesting story.
And essentially he writes a book, Richard Dreyfus does, and it's called Baby Steps. And it's just about the patient, whatever. I think it's very funny.
Very, very important.
Small, manageable steps along the way.
And you keep taking them. Anyone that's lost weight and kept it Davidoff will tell you it's about small steps, right? And that you just keep, you know, it's not about staying on the diet. It's about getting back on when you fall off the path, right?
How do you, when you made that mistake, you both said that external deadlines really are important. Far more yep. valuable and useful yep. and productive. How do you get an external deadline? I mean, let's assume our boss said to Marjorie and me, you got to write something for a meeting mm-hmm. next week. What do we say to him? Give us
yeah.
deadlines well, along the way?
Well, for I know. It's next week. Or you say, I do this all the time. I'll get you the story by 5 o'clock tonight.
Yeah, well, but, yeah,
and
but
then
if
you say
me,
to your boss.
But if he said to us,
up,
this is for a meeting next Wednesday, Tuesday night, we talk about it. How do I get away from that Tuesday night
you
syndrome?
You ask him, can we set a deadline for a draft on Saturday at noon?
Okay.
I mean, you can, yeah. again, small steps. You don't do this with everything. You take one aspect of your life. P.S. I think about writing, and I've written a number of books.
Writing is hard.
And writing is the most satisfying and the hardest thing I do. Horseback riding, which is all about patience, is almost as hard. But I say to my students, you will write when the pain of not writing becomes greater than the pain of actually writing. And that's really not a bad metaphor for a lot of what we're talking about. Right. If you recognize this in yourself, then taking a step toward creating an external deadline, toward cutting yourself off from a kind of distraction, toward making a priority list and then saying on this one thing, I'm going to stick to it, and getting that rush of self-satisfaction that tells you and relief that tells you you're on the right path is incredibly important. Right. And it is doing just what I say to my students. The pain of not doing this stuff and living in procrastination land is actually greater than the pain on this particular issue of taking some action. So I think that's really important. Last comment on this in the coaching milieu, if you will. Many years ago, Edmund Hillary, whom our listeners will know as a man who probably was the first to climb Mount Everest and died on the way back with his Sherpa.
I thought his Sherpa was the first one to
maybe,
make it.
Maybe. Forgive okay. me. Right up there, let's just say he broke new ground.
Okay,
all right?
Fine.
Here's what he had to say, and it's about climbing, but about life more generally. We do not conquer the mountain. We master ourselves.
And ooh, great quote.
It's a great quote. And you know, most of my leadership coaching is not about external toolboxes or, you know, you get this much power, you get this much access, you gather these resources. It's about how we work from within. And I think for those of us that want to cultivate a little bit of self-awareness in our life, thinking about the kind of small steps that we're talking about and experts talk about even more eloquently is really, really important because it really is about taking a step toward mastering ourselves, right? And it's often a small step, but those are really powerful. Last comment on this. Many years ago, a woman named Martha Beck, whom our listeners will know, many of them will know from the book she's read, written up about all kinds of things. She now runs a leadership coaching institute in Southern California. She got her leadership start with writing for O Magazine, Oprah Winfrey's magazine. She wrote a column on small steps. You know, on don't think you're failing to achieve your dreams because you're not taking huge steps and it's not all here. Take the first small step. Then take the one after that. Pick up the kids. Take a nap, have the difficult conversation. And then she goes on in the column to say, I've met thousands of people that the world thinks of as lucky, in quotes, and they all operate this way. Working hard, working smart involves working through procrastination and frustration and exhaustion and obstacles. And P.S., doing all that gets us, she says, to the terrifying tasks of living our right lives.
Okay.
So that is what we're talking about at some very fundamental level, mastering ourselves towards something that matters to us and gives us a sense of self-enlightenment and self-satisfaction.
So for those of us who spend a lot of time on the internet looking at procrastination and advice about procrastination, is there like a small little book or guide or something that people could get to talk that talks about baby steps and talking about that could help them?
So I wish I knew that, but I have so much kind of author envy about people who write self-help books and make $1 million that I don't read self-help books, so I don't know
I don't
them
think
as well.
They're out there, frankly, because I've looked.
Okay. So this article from Psychology Today has a bunch of stuff that's worked.
Okay.
So it's not written in a self-help vein, so I would recommend that.
That's the one by Eric Jaffe, J-A-F-F-E. Right.
There's a really, really interesting book out about a broader subject. You know, mastering yourself is really what it's about. And I think it's the best kind of business book I've ever read. In the modern context. It's by a guy, I think I've mentioned it before, but forgive me if I have. I didn't mention it in this context. It's by a guy named Jim Lehrer, not like PBS NewsHour, L-O-E-H-R. and it's called The Power of Full Engagement. And it's about how to live the story of your life as you want to, and it's all practical. It's built on a bunch of things, but it's all practical.
We got to end this. You know why we got to end this? Because, Marjorie, you and I have to start preparing for Nancy for next Tuesday. So let's get this over
with. We need a deadline.
May I share my one bit of thing?
Sure.
Thing that I did learn on one of these procrastination
What's
websites.
Up?
Well, that take your mail. I am horrible about my mail. That if you're going to open your mail, you open it once and you do something about it. Mm-hmm. You don't open it.
That's like
and
the
then
guy just mentioned, our former boss with the email. Exactly.
Exactly. So I have these massive piles of mail that I've opened and done nothing about.
Does it weigh on you?
Yes.
Yeah.
I look at this pile getting bigger and bigger and think, I have no idea. You know, I could be getting arrested and I have no idea.
Well, okay, since you brought it up, we only have 30 seconds left. Let me say, I went to the Herald only once in all the years Marjorie worked there. While she's writing a story, I'm waiting for her to go somewhere. She said, can you open my mail? I opened
I
my
didn't
mail.
I did say, can you open
well,
my
mail?
Well,
I chose mail. To open
you
your
volunteered.
Mail.
You volunteered.
I opened her piles and piles of mail, and the first thing I opened is a $500 check to a family that she had written a story about. That's totally
terrible,
true. Like
terrible.
A year and a half before.
Check it expired.
Hopefully that should do it. In any case, Nancy, on that sad note, it's a pleasure to see you as always.
Okay, Nancy Kane is a historian at the Harvard Business School. Do you procrastinate?
I do.
Okay. All right. She's guilty. She's guilty, too.
She's a procrastinator at the Harvard Business School.
She's a procrastinator at the Harvard, legendary procrastinator, where she holds a James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, much fun, as always.
As always.
Okay. We're opening up the lines at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. If you're a procrastinator, do you think it's good for creativity and for decision-making, or do you hate yourself for procrastinating but just cannot break the spell? From taxes to paying bills to writing that thank you note. When do you put things off and how do you put things off? 877-301-8970 is the number.
So let me tell you where I am on this, Marjorie, if I didn't make it clear with Nancy Kane. 877-301-8970 was one part where I am. One, I am totally convinced, I don't care what anybody says, I do better work when I am up against the deadline. And however, I am equally convinced it has shortened my life, and I mean it. The tension and anxiety that is created by waiting to the last minute is just, I mean, there's a physical feeling that I can't describe adequately that is so unpleasant, but my body knows it, that I can't describe. But I'm telling you, if you say to me, can you write me something on X? And I'll say, sure. And you say, well, it's due next Friday. If I say I'm going to do it tonight, I guarantee it's going to be half the quality that it would be if I waited till Thursday night or Friday afternoon to do it.
Well, that.
Well, that's my
because
life experience.
I think if you have a reasonable deadline, but if you have an unreasonable deadline, we have to do something really, really fast. You don't have time to take any chances. You don't have time to be creative. You don't have time to really sit back and think and perfect that turn of phrase because you're in a mad dash. I think revising and rewriting and editing is
no pressure, no quality. That's my experience. I mean, everybody's different. I guess everybody's different, but I have to say it has worked for me, but I'm totally convinced that the physical reaction I get means I'm going to live a shorter life.
Well, the tension is huge. I remember back when everybody used to smoke cigarettes. You know, I've been around so long that newspapers used to, the people used to smoke cigarettes.
In the newsrooms,
oh,
yeah.
They smoked cigars, yeah. Too. And around deadline, you'd hear, you know, not only the furious typewriters, this wasn't that long ago, it was like 25 years ago, the furious typewriters, but this cloud of billowing smoke everywhere. Everybody's in a frantic panic to get their stories. And I'm not sure you do your best work in those kind of frantic situations, Jim.
Let's take a few calls. Sarah, you're in JP, Jamaica Plain. You're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Thanks for the call, Sarah.
Okay, so this is my take on procrastination.
Please.
I put it in the same bag as chronic lates. And I was at a workshop on addiction some years ago. And the person who was giving it included chronic lates as a sign of addiction. And I got to sit with her at lunch and I said, how does this work? And she said, it's an adrenaline addiction and that people need that shot. And you people will, I noticed myself doing this since this has been explained to me. I'm not a chronic late. I'm still sort of a maybe late, but people need that shot of adrenaline and that whatever flows through you when you realize that you have this whole bunch of stuff to do. So so I propose that procrastination, maybe I don't know so much with mail, but particularly with other types of things, is has to do with our need for that shot of adrenaline.
I love that analysis, by the way. I never thought of it, and I think it explains that shot of adrenaline. It maybe explains what I was saying to you, Marjorie, a couple of minutes ago. Sarah, thank you for the call. You know what's another thing, by the way? Forget deadlines. How about things that don't have deadlines, but you know you have to do? When they languish forever, how miserable does it make you feel? Bless you. Marjorie's about to sneeze or cough or she did something. In any case, 877-301-8970. Let's go to Arlington, where Maddie is on the phone. Maddie, you're on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
And I just want to say that it's nice to be able to eat off the dining room table once in a while. So when the pizza's have taken over, then you know eventually you have to clean it up.
That's a great line, Maddie.
Or you can just put it in a big pile and move it to the floor under one of the chairs or something like that. I've done that more than once, you know, in the extra chair that nobody's sitting in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Maddie, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. So you're a procrastinator, too. Do you ever try to fix it?
I spent my whole life trying to fix it. I've taken courses and everything.
No, you have not.
I certainly
have. You've taken courses?
Yes, I have. I'm, you know, taking baby steps and line things up. Like Nancy was talking about, you do the most important things first, or you don't go to, you know, the 12th thing you're supposed to do before you've done at least one, and give yourself breaks and come back.
Have you sued the course leaders to get your money back, or you haven't been able to find a lawyer willing to
take
the case?
I am trying. I do get all enthusiastic about it, though. And I am on a new – this week I'm trying to open the mail just once.
Well, you're also in a different world. I think you said to Nancy at the Herald, you had strict deadlines 3 times a week, and it's much more open-ended at the Globe, is it not?
And I'm just a total basket case.
That's great. Let's go to Emily in Cambridge. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Emily.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Oh, I love Nancy so much. I love when she's on, and
so
I
we.
Love this topic.
So
oh, she's great. And actually, Marjorie, I have a quote for you that might help you with your procrastination a little bit.
I'm ready.
Oh, okay. Get a pen here, because it's discipline is about choosing. Let me see if I have this right. Discipline is the difference between choosing what you want now and what you want the most.
That's pretty good, actually. That is
Isn't
really
that pretty
good.
Good?
I like
because
that.
Because
every
time, I think that's the answer to people when they try to lose weight or they put things off. It's, you know, that struggle between what they really want now and what they want the most. And I just wanted to say that I loved everything that Nancy was saying. And what they kind of talk about, Marjorie, you're touching that a little bit about breaking it down, taking the biggest tasks.
Yes.
You know, breaking them down into very kind of small, bite-sized chunks. So when you're on the phone, maybe you can clean out the kitchen drawer, you know, things like that. I think that's really important. But what they talk about is if you have your list the day before, the night before your next day, you go and highlight, you know, 3 to 5 items that are your top priority items that have to get accomplished the next day. And that is what you focus on. Forget everything else. Just focus on those 3 to 5 items. And I was thinking about when you guys said your boss, who had the clean email account.
Yes.
Yeah, at the old place, yeah.
It's great. My only criticism to that is they say you're not supposed to, he's in reaction mode. So every time an email comes in, he's reacting to it. So he's not getting anything done. So I think it's a wonderful thing to do. I just caution people. It's kind of like you don't check social email in the morning. And I also recommend you don't check your email in the morning because then you're reacting to everybody.
Emily, are you a therapist? What are you? Are you a therapist or something? It sounds like this is not just a on-the-side. What
actually,
do you do?
I'm actually a business coach, funny enough. But
okay.
I actually just wrote a book for creative entrepreneurs on how to get their business started.
Well, feel free to promote it. What's the name of the book?
Oh, well, thank you so much. It's called Make, Sell, Repeat. And it should be coming out. Amazon bookstores, everything.
Great.
Emily, one last quick question. So when are you supposed to check the email, at night?
Well, I do it twice a day. I do it at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m.
Okay.
By the way, I do almost the exact same thing. I check it 200 times a day, Emily, so it's very similar to your. Emily, thank you for the call. You know what the other problem is with our farm boss?
You can't get, if you're constantly checking your email, you
can't
get anything
done. Well, there's another thing about immediate response, even though you have a clean, simpler life.
Yeah, if you're ticked off.
You don't have time to reflect on things because you choose not to. It's sort of like, even though Nancy called it poppycock, the guy waits the last minute, says, because you have the, I'm not defending his position. I think I'm explaining it. You have the maximum amount of time to actually think about what you want to do or what you want to think before you go ahead and do that kind of thing. 877-301-8970.
Jeff on the Mass Turnpike. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Jeff.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Great to talk to you guys.
Thanks
you too.
For calling.
I struck a note I said to the producer about thank you notes. I did the Pan Mass Challenge this year, and whenever I got a donation – there was no way possible I could procrastinate on that. I just, the guilt would kill me. I had to, boom, handwrite a note and get it out in the mail within no more than a day after I got it.
Wow.
I had to. I just felt like I owed it to my people, the sponsors, that donated to that cause. But, however, one thing I think procrastination does give you is wisdom, because I've learned, being in sales, the more you procrastinate and the more you don't prepare, like even the night before, you get burned so bad. You don't sleep well. You're thinking about it. You know, even if it's just like loading up your cars with samples of things you have to do for the next day, I always do it the night before. I just have to.
Can I tell you, Jeff is describing the situation, I'm getting that physical feeling back. It's not even me who's doing the procrastinating. Jeff, that was a great call. It's a horrible connection, though, so we got to let you, we have to let you go. You know, by the way, also, and I think I mentioned this, Nancy, too, yeah. When he said he has to write his pan mass challenge thank yous right away, when you don't write a thank you or you don't do a responsive thing to anything, it becomes 10 times harder.
Yeah.
Because then you have to explain why it is you didn't respond to whatever it is they did or said or whatever to you. So every rational argument speaks not to immediate action, but early on action, not procrastination. But I just can't break it. I can't break it.
I have nightmares about what's going to happen when I don't prepare. And then they come true. Terrible. Julia from Arlington. What do you think, Julia?
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
So I don't procrastinate. I prepare and I plan and I break my tasks down into doable pieces. And I always leave a day or two space between finishing something and handing it in.
Oh.
So I have a chance to make sure I catch all those little tiny things that you can't catch if you're just fixating on the task.
How did you get to this place, Julia?
Well, I mean, I've been very pragmatic in my career from college on. I never pulled an all-nighter. I just did what I needed to do to get things done. And I prioritize primarily. I think really prioritizing things in life allows you to not procrastinate. So I do what's most important. I make sure that's done. And then I move on to the things I might want to do in addition.
Wow.
Now, Julia, did you lord it over your classmates that you finished the papers 2 days in advance? I think you're like Hillary Clinton. I think she finished 2 weeks in advance. I mean, they must have, you know, you sound like a wonderful person, but I would find that, I would want to like strangle you, Julia, if you told me that.
You know, Julia,
she's heard it before, I
thank
guess.
Thank you for your call. Could you not hear in Julia's voice? It's interesting. When you do
she's so
talk
calm.
Radio.
Yeah.
Exactly. If 10 people spoke to us in a row, we should have done this at the beginning of the segment,
mm-hmm.
and said, just talk to us for a second. And after they had talked to us for 30 seconds, we would guess whether or not they were a procrastinator or not. Would you not have known that Julia was not a procrastinator?
She
was calm.
Like, I know.
She was measured. She had total control of the whole thing.
Now,
there.
That's the question. Does it come from your parents? Or if your parents are totally disorganized, do you react in the other direction?
I don't know.
Or, you know what I mean?
I don't know.
I mean, I know some people that have everything in folders. You know, they have those plastic folders and they've got everything there. Everything there.
Speaking of that, when you mentioned folders, which has nothing to do with one of my favorite folder stories, is I was at some supermarket a couple of years ago, and I had one coupon with me, and I was looking for it. It was one of my pockets, and the woman in front of me had all of her coupons in a mini
plastic
file thing.
Folder, yeah.
Like one was for produce, one was for canned goods, in any case, we have about 30 seconds left. We're going to squeeze Lauren from Needham in really quickly. Lauren, go.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, it doesn't make it right or wrong how you do this stuff. A lot of it has to do with the way your brain works, and there are different learning styles and operation styles. And what I've found is that I come from a very visual family. We have a lot of artists in there. And I've had people come over and say, oh, my God, I've got to reorganize your dining room. You're using your dining room table as a loading dock and everything's out there. And they put things away, and the minute they're out of sight, they're literally out of mind.
Yeah.
That's true.
Oh, Lauren, I'm
That's
sorry,
true.
But we got
to
roll.
I had to look at those two-foot piles of mail every day, and it doesn't seem to do me any good, but I do look at them. Anyway, up next.
Marjorie's kids thought she was out of the house. She was actually sitting there behind one of the piles.
From Alexander Calder's Mobiles to the Demon Barber of Fleet Street, WGBH's Jared Bowen joins us to talk about the local art scene. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. The road trip movie has long been considered an American film genre. So how does it fare in the hands of two Englishmen?
You know what'll make this perfect now? Michael Bublé. Bit of Bublé. Do you like Bublé? Where do you stand on Michael Bublé?
His windpipe.
You don't mean that.
That's from the new movie, The Trip to Italy. Here with us in Studio 3 for his take on the latest movies, museum exhibits, and theaters arts editor, Jared Bowen. Jared is also the host of the TV show Open Studio. Hi, Jared. And Jared, before you even speak, you voted. You have an I Voted sticker on.
We're so impressed.
Tell us what you said about your I Voted sticker before we go on the air. We went on the air.
Oh, this is so pathetic. I have matched my shirt and my sweater to my I Voted sticker.
Color coordinated. It's beautiful.
Beautiful.
Completely. You
know. It's beautiful. So we just heard that great line. It was very funny. The trip to Italy. It is very funny, apparently. And yet, in the reviews I read, it didn't get like a lot of stars. So what's the deal?
Well, I think I came to this a little bit late because I have not seen the first film. Now, people might not realize that this is sort of a sequel. In the first film, Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, who are two great English comedians and stars, we know Steve Coogan very well from a lot of American films, including Night at the Museum, they toured around England, and they play fictionalized versions of themselves. And that film did so well because they have such great chemistry that they decided to revisit it, and it gets very meta in the film because they discuss, you know, the worth of actually reteaming, so they're addressing their sequelness. And so this time they tour around Italy, and I loved it. Having not seen the first one, and maybe they tread too much on territory for the first one, I thought this one was terrific. It's got all these great elements because they're two really exceptionally funny characters, and much of the comedy is built on the impersonations that they do from Tom Hardy and Dustin Hoffman and Woody Allen and Hugh Grant. I mean, they do an amazing Hugh Grant impersonation.
Oh.
Just
great.
So funny. And then they have this, you know, fun chemistry together. They're driving around Italy in this little Mini Cooper listening to Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill. I mean, this is not what you expect from two middle-aged guys. So it's just really, really fun. And then it's sumptuous and beautiful because it's Italy in summertime and they're going up and down the coast. And
there's a lot of food focus, too, yes?
I made the mistake of going before dinner. And I was starving by the time I got it. You see all this Italian food served so sublime. And you see the preparation and you see them eating in these fine linens and these great restaurants and hotels all through Italy, the Isle of Capri. They're basically doing this grand poets tour, so they're also sort of chasing Shelley and Byron, and it's really fun.
Okay, so I'll know the stars and go.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm so obsessed with the color coordination thing. I can't even focus on the film.
So let's move on.
Fashion has no bounds, even on election day, Jim.
Let's move on to a big hit of the summer, Guardians of the Galaxy. Let's hear a little sound. Bradley Cooper, by the way, plays a raccoon, apparently, in this one. Here's some sound from Guardians of the Galaxy. It's Peter Quill, played by Chris Pratt, has to team up with a team of intergalactic misfits and miscreants to save the galaxy.
I look around. You know what I see? Losers. I mean, like, folks who have lost stuff. Their homes. Our families, and we're facing a threat that could destroy us all. If we're gonna save the galaxy, we're gonna have to do it together, partners.
Why would you want to save the galaxy?
Because I'm one of the idiots who lives in it.
Okay, worth the massive hitdom it's achieved?
Yes. I mean, that sounds like the worst trailer I've ever heard.
The worst.
It's one of the worst in a long time. But this movie is really, really fun. So I'm not a big comic book person, so a lot of these characters are new to me, but it's Peter Quill. He's Star-Lord. Nobody knows that he's Star-Lord, whether you're me or anybody in the movie. They don't know who this character is he's supposed to be portraying. But it starts off in this very sentimental way. He's just lost his mother to cancer. He runs out into a field as a child and gets swooped up by a spaceship. And flash forward to he's in this galaxy and all of these warlords flying around him. And he's somebody who basically subsists on this mixtape of this 80s music that he carries around. The whole film revolves around getting this orb, which basically gives all the power to whoever its holder is. And he and his team of miscreants need to rescue the orb. And it's Bradley Cooper playing a raccoon. Vin Diesel is a large tree, which is actually hilarious. I mean, both of them are exceptionally funny. And it really dispenses with all the tropes of the summer blockbuster. Whenever somebody starts to launch into some giant speech and the music swells, they get obliterated by some comet or something.
Oh, good.
it's very, very tongue-in-cheek, and it knows what it's doing.
Did I read that the soundtrack is fabulous, too? Is that this? Yes?
This mixtape that he carries around, it's hilarious. Yeah, it's great. It's all 80s music. It's everything that we love.
Well, I'm not a superhero kind of guy myself, but I've actually
despite
read
the cape that you're wearing? I mean, you talk about my fashion.
By the way, with my I Voted sticker. It's unbelievable.
How did you know he wears capes? He does, you know, in the off hours.
No, it's only when I do my Zorro thing, which is a whole separate topic. Okay, here is a little sound from Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. How can it be bad after that title? It's a sequel to 2005's Sin City, based on the comic books, graphic novels, I guess, too. Frank Miller, here it is.
I need your help. Needs going up against a lot of guns.
I'm gonna kill Rourke.
Count me in.
Power is a fragile thing. I need them to know the price of defiance. Now. Who wants to play?
Who wants to play? Is this tongue-in-cheek or is this the real deal here? And I have to say I'm not familiar with Frank Miller.
Yeah, no, this is the real deal. Well, the first Sin City came out about 9 years ago, so people have been waiting a very long time for this. I also really enjoyed this. It's funny, late summer, anything that comes out in August typically is not worth seeing, but I think late summer this year we saw a lot of really good films, including this one. And Frank Miller is a graphic novelist, artist, comic book guy, and he teamed with Robert Rodriguez, the great director, who in some passages of this film actually take his graphic novels frame by frame, you know, this very evocative, as I said, graphic novel illustrations, put that onto the screen. And so a lot of the film is black and white with just splashes of color here and there. It's got a terrific aesthetic style. And the cast here is terrific. It's Jessica Alba and Bruce Willis and Josh Brolin, Mickey Rourke, Powers Booth, who you just heard. That was the last voice you just heard. And it's really broken up into four different stories that the fans know very, very well. And I would say that three of them are really good. I could have dispensed with the last one with Jessica Alba and Bruce Willis, but it all sets people down in this Gotham-like city with this power struggle, the young guy, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, trying to take down the senator and the femme fatale who's just toying with Josh Brolin. It's very engaging in terms of all the way, the different ways that it interplays.
I'll tell you, when I read the New York Times review this morning, when there's a line in a movie which is, quote, "I'm a selfish slut who threw away the only man she ever loved." I'm sorry, she's a selfish slut. Oh, I'm a selfish slut who threw away the only man she ever loved. It can't get much better than that. You know, one last thing, though. You know, occasionally I get stuck on one of the actors or actresses you mentioned. Bruce Willis. Now, you're too young to remember Moonlighting, which was the television show with Cybill Shepherd that got him started.
It's terrific.
Essentially, he started pursing his lips in a particular fashion, 25 years ago? He does the exact same thing in every single movie, but people love this guy. You apparently do too, yes?
He does, and I think, and this is why he's cast in this role, because he's got that look. Yeah, I remember watching Moonlighting a little bit, but Die Hard, definitely. And this is the action hero guy that you want to see. This is why he's been cast cast in this movie, and here it plays beautifully. They all play up, you know, especially Mickey Rourke.
Oh, tell me.
A lot of their characters are sort of with animation, different faces and costumes and whatnot, but he's Mickey Rourke to the 1,000th degree.
So he's good, because his career has been sort of up and down, up and down. He's back on and up in this movie.
Well, I think Mickey Rourke is somebody who needs a good director, and that's exactly what he needs, good material, and he needs a good director, and that's what he has here.
Okay, let's move to the stage. Here is, in the preview of Finding Neverland of the 2014 Tony Awards, Jennifer Hudson, who can sing a little bit, sings Never Neverland with the Finding Neverland cast. Listen to this.
Whenever I am frightened, if I ever feel alone, I turn to the night sky. And a star I'll call my own. Somewhere I can run to, just across the Milky Way. If you like, I can take you. It's just a light year and a day.
You're kidding me.
Jennifer Hudson. God. Didn't she like lose in American Idol or come in second place or third place or something like that?
I think she came in eighth or
yeah,
something.
She didn't get close to the top. I guess I made a mistake on that one.
Yeah, one anyway, Oscar later.
Yeah. Anyway, Neverland's at the ART in Cambridge and headed to Broadway. Tell us about it.
I you're going to make fun of me because I always seem like the Pollyanna here, but this is a really fantastic show. This is a story. It's based on the film with Kate Winslet and Johnny Depp, Finding Neverland, and it's been adapted for the stage. This is the second time, by the way, it's been adapted for the stage. Harvey Weinstein, who was behind the film, handpicked Diane Paulus for this latest iteration, and it tells the story of J.M. Barrie, who wrote Peter Pan. And this really documents the process by which he created Peter Pan and the influences in the Davies family, these four young boys who he came to spend a lot of time with, and one of them, Peter, eventually, of course, became largely the inspiration for this character of Peter Pan and the sense of never wanting to grow up. But you see, the show works on many, many different levels. First of all, the music is fantastic. It's hummable. It's passionate. It's fun. You have Jeremy Jordan, who's a great Broadway star. He was in Newsies and lately of Smash on television, who plays J.M. Barrie, and he's got such warmth and heart and such great chemistry and rapport with these kids on stage. And this guy can sing and he can dance and he's so entertaining. You have Laura Michelle Kelly playing Sylvia Llewellyn Davies. She's beautiful. And if you remember what happens in the film, there's sort of a tragic ending there too. So you have this great love story for both how she becomes enamored of Barry and of the children. And then in the hands of Diane Paulus, this show is just over the, I don't mean to say over the top in a bad spectacle way, but it's just theater, I think, in its finest forms there at the ART. My only criticism is that the pacing is a little bit too quick sometimes at the expense of story, but that it's a minor quibble because it's a lovely, lovely piece.
You know, I wanted to ask you, Diane Paulus is, of course, a superstar. Many of her productions at the ART have gone on to Broadway. The Breaking Bad, I always get called the Breaking Bad thing. It's not the Breaking Bad.
All the Way.
All the Way.
About LBJ.
About LBJ went to Broadway, where it was apparently tweaked some. I've heard from people who saw it at the ART and saw it in Broadway. Will that happen again? You mentioned the pacing. Will that happen to Neverland? Will it get tweaked before it opens in New York?
Oh, no doubt. And what happens is they had a very long preview period here, which typically they have on Broadway, and that's the period which they all work on it. And with Harvey Weinstein backing, they knew from the beginning it was going to Broadway, so they really wanted to get this. And they use the audience reaction, and they use every single night to tinker with the show and reconfigure. And, I mean, they're tossing out script pages and adding new songs here and there right up until opening night when they freeze the show. And then it stays. But yes, undoubtedly it'll be changed before it goes to Broadway. And people listening will probably say, I can't get tickets right now, but I do understand if you call the box office and ask to be put on a waiting list, that's your chance because it is sold out. But I think when tickets do get released, the box office will call you. But it is, if you can go or if you have tickets already, it is your chance to see this before it goes to Broadway. And I think it'll do exceptionally well.
And tell them Jared Bowen sent you. But one last question. This is a great play to introduce your kid to the stage with, is it not?
Absolutely. Yeah. The show is 2 hours and 45 minutes. It feels like 80 minutes. It flies.
So one show not to introduce your young child to the stage on is Sweeney Todd.
No, I don't think
at the
so.
Lyric I'm so glad to have seen, I didn't see this production, actually have seen something you're talking about for a change. There have been about 4 million productions of this, have there not?
There have endless productions, yeah.
And what did you think of this one?
This one is pretty good. I saw it on Sunday, and it's directed by Spiro Voludos, who just ended the Lyrics last season with Into the Woods, another great Sondheim musical. And
wait, there's a little hesitation in your voice here. What's the problem?
My only hesitation is maybe I saw it a little too soon because Stephen Sondheim's music is so challenging. If you listen to any of his songs, or Christine Ebersole, the great Broadway actress, once explained to me is it's fairly mathematical. I mean, there's the change register, the notes, and the rapidity of his music is it's just so fast, and there's so much to keep up with that I often felt during this show that the actors were trying, while they did very capable jobs, and he is a master. A really great team of singers, a cast of singers here, that sometimes they were trying to keep up with the music a little too much at the expense of story. The second act is much better in this show. And I would say it is worth seeing, especially if you love Sondheim. But the second act where Sweeney Todd comes to his full brutal glory as the demon barber of Fleet Street and is exacting revenge, it all revolves around the fact that his wife... He's basically lost his wife and he lost his daughter by sort of the upper crust of London who found her very beautiful and wanted to imprisoned him so that they could get to his daughter. And he finally, released from prison, wants to exact revenge, partners up with Mrs. Lovett and they make their meat pies in London. And
Jared, before we leave this, how hard is it when you've seen something so many times to do your job, meaning to step back and say, how good is this when you've heard the music so much and the music is so complex and you've seen, how hard is that?
Well, it's a really good question. It all depends on the director. I last saw this on Broadway with John Doyle directing and Patti LuPone, and that was the version where John Doyle had all of his actors on stage play their instruments. They didn't have, if memory serves, they didn't have an orchestra. All the actors are playing the instruments. So here you have Patti LuPone as Mrs. Lovett marching around with a big tuba for most of the show. So as long as they're doing something different, and Spiro Voludos has such an appreciation for Sondheim, he stages it very classically, but it's also very different from the last version I saw, which makes it fresh for me.
We're talking with WGBH arts editor Jared Bowen. Jared, let's move on to museums. I'm mortified to say I didn't even know about the historic Cape Ann Museum.
Make that
in Gloucester.
Two of us since
Make
you
that three of us.
Until I read about it's reopening after a big facelift. So tell us about this museum.
Yeah. I had no idea either, and I think this is part of their problem, and now they've had a $3.5 million renovation, so hopefully people are going to find out about it, and I'm happy to tell this story. But as you know, Cape Ann is gorgeous.
Gorgeous.
Gloucester, Rockport. Artists have always been drawn to Cape Ann because of the beautiful light, the lighthouses, the industrious harbor with ships steaming in and out. And the Cape Ann Museum is there to tell this story, and so it's filled with maritime memorabilia. But also the great artists who've come to Gloucester throughout their lives. FitzHenry Lane, I didn't even realize this, spent all of his life working in Gloucester. And so they have a huge collection of his paintings, many of which never even left Cape Ann. They went directly from the family to the museum.
Hopper, Winslow, too? Or
Edward Hopper's there, Homer.
It's great.
What is really spectacular, Jim, about this is you will look at this, especially there's one illustration by Homer that I remember seeing just when I was there last month. You look at this rendering of the harbor and of Gloucester. You move to a window about 20 feet away in the museum. You look out, and it looks exactly the same.
That is
I know. Doesn't it give it goosebumps?
Great.
It's true. There's just this picture that goes with the story, the FitzHenry Lane picture of the harbor from Rocky Neck. I mean, if you've been there, you say, oh, my gosh. I mean, the boats are different, obviously, but the view is not.
Yeah, so you have this tremendous appreciation. They also added this Fresnel light, which looks like this giant piece of sculpture, but it came from one of the two lighthouses on Rockport's Thatcher Island. It's fabulous.
Speaking of sculpture, let's move to a museum that not only have we heard of, it's one of my all-time favorite museums. I think Marjorie loves it,
too.
Peabody Essex, you haven't been up to Salem. This is one of the great day-long treats. What's there now? Well, this Calder thing, obviously. What's the deal?
Well, I am so excited about this. Calder happens to be one of my personal favorite artists, and they have a major exhibition exhibition of Alexander Calder right now. He's the sculptor who basically invented mobiles. And if you know his pieces, they're intricately balanced sculpture with flashes of color that subtly move. So you watch the pieces move, but you also watch the choreography he's done with shadows and the way that they move. This was organized by the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and it's its only East Coast stop. And they have 40 Calder sculptures between the mobiles, his stationary sculptures, and then the models for major public installations that he did. And Calder's story is fascinating. He grew up on the East Coast from a family of sculptors, but wanted to get away from traditional sculpture. So he went to Paris in the 1920s, and he's with Duchamp and Juan Miró and Kandinsky, that whole tribe of people. And he came back to the U.S. and basically invented this whole new means of sculpture in modern art.
Tell people about what he did with Josephine Baker. That's just incredible. Okay, it's a picture. It's like it looks like she's in a cage, you know, the famous singer, and it's like a mobile of her kind of hanging there. I don't know that it's in this going to be in this exhibit, but I just thought it was incredible. There she is, pieces of her body hanging in the cage. It's fantastic.
Well, the representation that he does is absolutely incredible. And he was so mathematical and an engineering genius to be able to do the balance that he's done. In fact, they told me there's one expert who goes around and does all of the Calder reinstallations.
You know, I feel like I'm giving parenting advice during this, Jared Bowen.
No,
let
great.
Me say the
You're
two
right.
plays. We had Malcolm Rogers here in the other day. If you want to start your kids on museums,
yeah.
The MFA, and then drive up to Salem. The Peabody Essex is manageable. It's not huge. They have done such. Do you like this as much as we do this place?
I love the Peabody
it's
Essex
great.
Museum.
It's not overwhelming.
Beautiful.
It's not
That's
overwhelming.
Exactly right.
They had the funniest thing. It's probably long gone by now, but I went there a few months ago, and they had this great thing. You always wonder why dogs stick their heads out the window in the car, and they want the wind in their face, and you see them all driving around. They had this whole big thing explaining about it, like a psychedelic trip it is for dogs, have their heads out the window. And they had this huge picture of this dog flying down the highway with his head out. It was just great. And it was like 3D and active and interactive. And I just love it.
Jared, it's great to see you.
It's great to see you. I'm going to have to try that. Marjo, we've carpooled a couple times. Maybe next time I can stick my head out the window. I like that idea.
Absolutely.
Well, I want to see that, so let me know.
Okay, Jared Bowen. Well, I don't know if it's there now. Double check. But it was great when it was. Jared Bowen is WGBH Arts Editor, and he's also host of Open Studios, which you can see every Friday night at 8:30 on Channel 2. Thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow to hear from all the winners in today's primary elections, plus Globe editor Brian McGrory, our Homeland Security expert Juliet Kayyem, just hours before the president's big speech on ISIS. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our production team, Chelsea Mers, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Wayland, and our engineer, John Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
Welcome to Catherine. And Marjorie, you better go vote. Are you going to go vote?
As soon as I step out of the studio, Jim, I'm heading right over there.
And I am Jim Browdy.
I have to get my hair cut first. See you later.